Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
We're back. It's 12 after. 800-531-3815, toll-free coast-to-coast. I'm Jim Blasingame. The Small Business Advocate, Joan Pride, is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And Joan, welcome back.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's good to have you back on the
show. Thank you.
It was fun seeing you again face-to-face this week.
It sure was.
My visit to Washington, D.C. And
tell them where we were.
We were at the National Press Club.
The National Press Club.
Yeah. It was fun. I've become a member of that fine organization. Joan has been for a long time, and it was fun to meet there and see you again. You and our other buddy, one of our other buddies over there, Kiplinger, Ken Dalecki. It was a nice lunch to have. I appreciate you guys giving us some time. Joan, let's get into the letter and talk about some deflation. You know, this word deflation keeps rearing its little ugly little head, doesn't it?
Well, and for those of us raised in an era of high inflation, it wouldn't occur to one on the surface that deflation would be so bad. Oh, falling prices, that sounds great. Well, theoretically it does, but when it really hits the economy, it's not so great.
When it becomes a systemic economic condition, like happened in the 30s, like has happened more recently in Japan, it really is a downward spiral that feeds on itself, and it's a very, very dangerous and a very it's just a very dangerous situation. And
it's kind of funny because in the 70s we had spiraling inflation, and that was terrible, mm-hmm. and that had bad effects. And now if you were to go in the opposite direction, you would have opposite effects but equally bad.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing is, it does seem though, Joan, that the economists truly fear deep deflation much worse than they fear steep inflation.
Right. In fact, there was just an article in the Wall Street Journal today saying that the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank made it very clear this week. They aren't usually very clear about anything, but they made it clear that they are more worried about deflation than inflation, which for them is a real turning point.
Well, and as you guys pointed out in your letter this week, the one of the biggest weapons that the Fed has, the Federal Reserve Board has, for deflation is lowering interest rates.
Inflation,
yeah,
they don't have much room left.
They're almost out of ammunition. They're down to 1.25 on the Fed funds rate, which is pretty close to zero. And the thing is Joan, as you know, in Japan, the equivalent Fed funds rate in Japan got down to a quarter of a point. It still didn't help over there. So
that's right.
So that's just kind of a scary situation that we've got a little bit with that. But there are other things though that are aligning right now that can kind of help fight this off. For one thing, taxes are being lowered. They're not being raised. The economy is actually kind of hanging in there pretty well. A lot of the deflation that we have is really good deflation, isn't it?
Well, that's correct, and I think that's part of the important message here, is that in a lot of cases, a price drop is a good thing.
Well, and you guys point out in the letter that prices aren't widely dropping. A lot of the prices that are dropping are part of the good deflation scenario. My friend Gary Schilling wrote a book on deflation. He's been talking about this for 20 or more years, and he says that that there's good deflation and there's bad deflation. Good deflation is when your cell phone now costs $50 when it used to cost $500.
And that's a good example of what's been going on there. Yeah,
that's right. Bad deflation is when your house is not worth as much.
Right.
As it was.
When your assets are devalued.
Right. When commodities come down for no productive reason, but only because of the deflated value, like if cotton or soybeans or something like that reduced in value, that really low. It's not a rising tide; it's a lowering tide that sinks all boats, doesn't it?
Right. I also think it's important to look at how we're different from Japan, and I believe we are. Because I think you could look at Japan and say, oh, no, we might be heading the same way that they're heading. And I guess that's possible, but I think you can point out some differences that would sort of make us feel better, such as the situation with the banking industry.
Yeah, no question about it. Go ahead if you want to.
Well, Japan's banks were in much worse shape than ours. I mean, our banks are well capitalized. They don't have. I mean, they've had some bad loans on their books from the 1990s, but in essence, they're in pretty good shape. Unlike the Japanese banking industry, there's some companies and banks that needed to fail, to get them off the books, and they continue to be propped up.
The comparison, the best comparison to me, Joan, was what we did in the 80s when we found that we had a sick savings and loan industry. We actually went in and cleaned that out, and we paid the price. It was a lot of money.
The old Resolution Trust Corp. I remember
exactly.
It well.
You reported on that. Well, I'm sure quite a bit. And it cost us billions of dollars to fix that, but we did, and it really kind of set the stage for a prosperous 90s, didn't it?
Right. I mean, we kind of took our medicine, as it were, and Japan was never willing to do that.
They still haven't done that.
Pardon?
They still haven't done that, except only very recently. I've seen a few articles, Joan, where they're starting to write off some of that debt and maybe get some things worked out over there.
Which is fine, except that the average consumer is sort of the opposite of the American consumer. They just don't have the confidence to go out there and spend money.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and as a nation, they're not entrepreneurial. Not that individual Japanese citizens aren't, but as a nation, the soil is not very fertile over there for entrepreneurs in Japan.
Well, you think of Japan as being the land of the company man.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that there are some examples, good examples over there, but actually I think the examples between the U.S. and Japan actually demonstrate more why we probably won't have systemic debilitating deflation over there. Another thing that that you guys point out is that banks over here are actually still lending money, and that's one of the things that happens in deflation is that banks start tightening up.
Right, and I guess our banks have been a little bit tight, but not to the extent that Japanese banks have.
Right. Well, the thing is we just have to. I'm just glad that the Fed and the federal government is paying attention to this thing. We've got some good examples about what not to do, plenty of those. But it is an interesting time that we're living in right now, folks, and it's quite a bit different than any time that we've had in the last probably 40 years. There's a lot of historic things going on, especially with regard historic in terms of the lives of a lot of Americans. Many of us have never seen this sort of thing before.
That's right.
20 after, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Joan Pryde.
Gonna tear a freight train.
Back at 23 after. Joan Pryde is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors. And Joan, we're talking about deflation and a couple of other things that that Kiplinger reported this week that are indication that we've got some natural marketplace elements that are fighting off deflation. And that's that payrolls are going to rise about 3% this year.
That's right. And we're saying in certain classes of workers, wages will rise much more, and healthcare is one area, of course, where that's going to be the case.
Right.
And
plus
we say personal income will be up marginally.
Mm-hmm. Plus, we've already paid for the stock market bubble.
Right. That bubble has burst, has not caused deflation, so that's
one thing
over.
One thing you didn't report on, I don't think it's in the letter here, I didn't see it, Joan, that I'm a little surprised that you didn't put in there, and that was about the possible real estate bubble.
Well, that's a good
point.
Isn't
that an issue? Isn't that an issue that could sort of turn things around the wrong way a little bit?
Well, I guess it could. I guess I'm trying to remember our last forecast. I think our forecast was that it just wouldn't pop suddenly and hurt the economy. That I guess we're saying certain areas will slow down, but like for example, my area in the Washington D.C. area shows no signs of slowing down. It's kind of hard to believe, but things are just as hot here as ever.
Well, and I'll tell you something else. I don't think that I hate to say it this way because it's almost like tempting fate. I don't want to do that, but I just don't see a national real estate bubble. If there is a bubble, right. it'll happen like happened in the 80s when we had overbuilding of commercial property and multifamily housing in Denver and Dallas and Houston and Phoenix and the Sun Belt areas where the general partners of all the tax shelter programs overbuilt and just that, there was that whole feeding frenzy. But it was just commercial. It was just multifamily. Those programs, those properties were absorbed over a period of time. They were actually all part of the RSA, not the RSA, the Resolution Trust. RTA.
Right.
RTA, I think is. They were part of that that
the
we
RTC.
Talked about earlier about RTC. I'm sorry. Thank you for that. The SNL bailout. It was all part of that. And so even then, that was a pretty big. Joan, that was a pretty big medicine to take, but even that wasn't any kind of a national issue as far as real estate's concerned. It didn't affect pricing in New York,
exactly, right,
or Miami,
right.
So I don't see. We've had rolling recessions across the country, where one area would be blighted economically, while an area 200 miles away would be doing great.
Right.
And I think if we have any kind of a real estate bubble, it'll be a rolling bubble. What do you think?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it'll be regional. And I'm sure that there's areas of the country now that are not in the middle of a bubble that don't even know what we're talking about, hardly.
Well, but so, I also know some markets, Joan, that actually have already, their prices are already
going down. Their bubble has already burst.
But it's not because of necessarily a national issue as much as it is just that the economy
got regional factors.
The a lot of the big plants that they'd relied on for 40 or 50 years are gone now, and they haven't figured out how to retool them. Therefore, property values have gone down.
Right. That makes sense.
So I think that's what we're going to see more than anything. And so I think the bottom line, Joan, is do we have deflation? Absolutely. Do we have good deflation? Yep. Do we have bad deflation? Yes. But is it going to become a national systemic situation? I think the answer is no. And you guys say
well, good.
That.
We agree then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's amazing that Kiplinger lurched uncontrollably to agree with me, right?
There you go.
Okay, let's move over to top of page two and talk about some good news for employers and bad news for employees, especially for people who've been probably abusing the Family and Medical Leave Act. What's up with that?
Well, it's kind of funny. I had an editor speaking to me last week reading this item saying, is that really true? Are people taking time off for a cold and calling it family leave, invoking the Family Leave Act? They're taking time in increments of, 1 or 2 hours? I said, yes, it's happening. This editor couldn't believe it, but that's some of the abuses that are occurring. That because the act was written so vaguely, there was sort of this vacuum here that people are sort of jumping into. And so now we're going to have rules that will take care of that.
Yeah. Exactly, and every time the sad news is every time you give somebody a little bit of a benefit, somebody's going to figure out a way to abuse it.
Right.
And won't you remind us a little bit about what the basic rules are for the Family
Medical Leave Act? Well, the reason the Family and Medical Leave Act was put in place, it was, I guess, a lot of it had to do with pregnancy, but it could be for caring for an elderly relative. But the idea is, I think you can have up to 3 months of unpaid leave, if as long as you are working with the company, I think at least a year, if I'm not mistaken. You have to be working with your company a certain amount of time. But under the federal rules, if you need that leave, the company has to grant it to you for, maternity leave, paternity leave, caring for a sick relative, and then here's the catch, or your own serious illness. But that has never been defined.
Right.
And that was part of what was causing the abuse. But the other part of the abuse was taking these tiny little increments of family medical leave, which part of the problem there is it's a big paperwork headache and administrative burden to track all these little increments.
Right. And, of course, this only applies to companies with 50 or more employees.
That's correct.
And the sad news is I actually know some companies who hold their employment to 49.
Wow.
So they don't have to comply with this.
That and other rules.
And you know what? I don't blame them because it can get really tough on a small company to have to deal with the Family Medical Leave Act. Stand by, Joan. We're going to take a quick break. It's 29 after. The show is brought to you by IBM and Office Depot. We'll be right back.
Yes. inspire small business.
We can teach these barbarians a lesson in Western methods and efficiency that will put them to shame.
He tells it like it is.
I realize how difficult it's going to be in this godforsaken place where you can't find what you need. And there's the challenge.
He's Jim Blasingame, the small business advocate.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
We're back. It's 20, no, actually, 34 after the hour. I'll learn to tell time eventually. Just be patient. Good to be with you today, as always. Thank you for hanging around with us today. If you've already been with us, good for you. If you just tuned in, welcome aboard. Joan Pride is our guest. She's senior editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and we're talking about the most recent Kiplinger letter, which is now in its 80th year. This September, they will be celebrating 80 years in existence, which is just amazing to me and very much a tribute to the people who work there and the owners, and which includes the employees, right, Joan?
Absolutely. That's right.
So it's one big happy family over there, and unless Joan gets a little grumpy, and then it's not quite as happy. Because when Joan's not happy, nobody's happy.
That's
folks.
Right.
Joan, I want to touch on just a little bit more on the family medical leave thing.
Sure.
I was mentioning a minute ago that it's down to 50. You have to have 50 or more employees for it to affect you. And if Senator Ted Kennedy, the arch enemy of small business, wants, if he has his way, he would lower it down to probably one.
Yes.
I mean, he's not the least bit happy with the fact that the Family Medical Leave Act only affects companies of 50 or more. But he doesn't realize that if you have five employees and one person leaves, you know, it's kind of hard to absorb that other job for that period of time.
Oh, no
really
question.
Makes a hardship
right.
On the company. And,
that's right.
And you know, companies don't get budgets from the federal government. We don't work off of budgets. We work off of financial statements. You know, we have to earn the money that comes in order to have any left over, you know, to go out. And I don't think he understands that. And so that's an issue that bears watching also for all small business owners. Let's move down and talk about this pension insurance revamping that's been going on. I know you reported on this week.
Right. Well, as you probably know, there's an organization called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which insures the pensions of defined benefit, you know, traditional pension plans in the
right.
country. It used to have a surplus, but there's been a lot of failing companies, particularly in the steel and airline industries, going into bankruptcy, and the pension winds up being controlled by the PBGC. So they now have a big deficit. And the easy way to get rid of that deficit would just be to hike insurance premiums on the companies that get the insurance. But instead, they're trying to find sort of more long-term ways of shoring up the PBGC.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those, for example, when a company is having financial trouble, often it might say to its workers, well, we won't give you a raise, but instead we'll make the pension benefits more generous. So that's a liability down the road that they don't have to worry about today. And
right.
it's often, if they do go under, it's often a liability that has to be picked up by the PBGC.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to make it harder. The idea is to propose legislation that would make it harder for companies to do that. So there's a whole range of things that they can do.
Well, it sounds like a domino effect that's happened with the excessive charges against certain industries have created a little bit of a crisis for a lot of different industries.
Exactly.
And which is not fair, but that's life, isn't it?
True.
Another thing, this is fascinating, Joan, I think it's really important that we pay attention to, and I'm glad you guys brought this up, and that's that even though right now with the 6% unemployment nationally, you know, we might not think that there's we're not too concerned about a worker shortage right now, but that's really what we have right now is really just kind of a temporary thing, isn't it?
Well, you see, we've got this, you know, baby boom bubble, you know, going through the population here, and what we're saying is we're going to have shortages as they retire. We're going to have to start having shortages later this decade.
Well, the way to look at it, folks, is if you look at the numbers on a scale, you've got almost 80 million baby boomers, who will begin retiring. Actually, some of them are already retiring, like if you're a teacher or military or, you know, some kind of a federal employee. Some of them are. I know many of my generation, Joan, who are already retired. But from a standpoint of mass retirement, many of them can start retiring in about 5 years, as you guys point out.
That's right.
And 80 million of us, and only 30 million of the generation behind us. Joan, that's a lot of difference, isn't it?
That's why I often worry about things like Social Security, because you're going to have such a lower number of people paying into the system
in
a few years, and so many more taking it out.
That's exactly right. It's going to be a problem, but also it's going to be a problem for those of us who are employees, who are hiring workers, and that's another reason, folks, to use technology to grow your business productively with technology more first, and then hire people second.
Right.
I think we're going to have to do that eventually. Tony Till, stay with us. We'll be right back with Joan Pryor. We're back. 17 Till. Joan Pryor is our guest. Let me remind you, in the show straight ahead, I will be in Highland County, Virginia, over in Monterey, Virginia. I'm going to be delivering a keynote speech there tomorrow night and at their Small Business Week kickoff, and really looking forward to being with them. And I'm going to, on the show tomorrow, I'm going to be interviewing a number of different people in that community who are community leaders, who are business leaders. There's a business incubator who got this whole thing rolling to get me over there, that I'm going to be talking to their director, some of their board members, some of the tenants in that incubator over there, the business incubator. And so we've just got several different people that you're going to be meeting. You're going to find out how communities are working to grow their economies. You'll learn a lot about what people are doing. These people are doing to make sure that their economy doesn't get left behind. And it's just a really fascinating part of what I do is to be able to talk to these people and see the different things that they're doing to make sure that their economy doesn't that their local economy gets a piece of the world economy action.
Right, that's
and
a good point.
It's a lot of fun. You'll enjoy meeting these people, and I'm looking forward to introducing them to you. Joan, let's move on down and talk about this wireless high-speed internet issue that's coming up. The three companies have kind of come up with a standard, haven't they?
That's right, and that's so important. You know, you go back to the old battles over, for example, VHS versus Beta, and you see where you have to have one standard that everybody agrees to.
Right.
And now that this has occurred, we're saying that you're going to see high-speed service to businesses without needing the phone company to lease a line from them.
Because it's going to be wireless.
Exactly.
Now, we've talked about Wi-Fi on this show before, folks, and that's where, for example, one of my laptops has got Wi-Fi, wireless fidelity, 802.11b capability, which allows me to operate off of a wireless router, but that wireless router is hooked up to a wired broadband connection. And so ultimately, it winds up being wired, but what we're talking about now is totally wireless connections. And like a cell phone, Joan.
That's right.
For example, right now, whenever I have been moving around with my laptop, if I were in a building where they had a wireless LAN local area network, I could connect up to their hotspot, which I would do. But if I'm in an area where, say I'm in an airport or in the back of a cab or something, and I wanted to hook my computer up to the internet, I wouldn't be able to do that. But
right.
with this kind of wireless high-speed connection, if I were a subscriber and if they had a cell nearby, I could hook up to it on the go, couldn't I?
Right, and that's going to proliferate. There's going to be more and more of those, so that you'll be able to hook up in more places over time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact,
I'm
sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I just read the other day that Verizon is going to start putting Wi-Fi capability into phone booths, so you don't actually have to be in the phone booth, but if you're near the phone booth, you can use your laptop or whatever and connect to the internet.
Exactly. This, folks, if you remember, over the last couple of years, people have said, what's the next killer app? And one of the things I've said is wireless.
Yeah.
The multiple and and different applications for wireless that we've talked about on the show, and it's something to think about. And it's not only handy, folks. It will change the way you do business, and so you need to pay attention to this issue a little bit more. Joe, let's move over to the top of page three and talk about some foreign policy issues that you guys reported on this week. Talk to us about the good cop, bad cop routine that's going on right now.
Well, that's right. You have the good cop being Secretary of State Colin Powell, and the bad cop being the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, or as we know him here locally, Rummy. Rumsfeld is considered the saber rattler, and he'll rattle that saber, and then Powell will walk into a country and find it much easier to negotiate whatever he needs to negotiate. And I'm talking about countries such good example, and I think the one that we use here is Syria.
Mm-hmm. Joan, do you remember, and I'm not saying that you guys stole my idea or anything, because you obviously are capable of coming up with your own ideas, but if you remember a year and a half ago, or over, at least a year ago, when people were saying, you know, that Mr. Bush was going too far and he was being too much of a hot dog and too much of a cowboy, and I pointed out that I believed what was happening, that people were missing, was that the administration had a good cop, bad cop thing going on. And I didn't think about Rumsfeld. I considered Mr. Bush to be the bad cop and Mr. Powell to be the good cop. And I said then that this is a good strategy. And you know, there's all this tension between, alleged tension between the State Department and the Defense Department. And some of it may be real, but I think a lot of it is staged, and I think it's very effective.
It's sure working so far. That's true.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, with all the things that have happened, Joan, and with all the dangerous things that have already happened, the unfortunate things, and all the things that could happen because of some of the bad actors out there, America, in my opinion, has got to stand up and say, you know what, like in that movie Network, I'm mad as hell, and we're just not going to take it
right,
anymore.
Right, exactly.
You know, I think that's I liked what Jon Stewart said. You know, the comedian on Comedy Channel. He says he calls it you want a piece of this diplomatic policy. You want a piece of this policy. I like that. Let's move on down and talk about advertising on police vehicles. Joan, you've been seeing a lot of this. You guys reported on that this week, where they want to put advertisement on police vehicles. Are you for that or against it?
Well,
you get my opinion. Hang on to that, Joan. I'm going to let you give your opinion about it when we come back after these messages. That's when I'm going to give mine, too. Stay with us. 10 till. We'll be right back.
What would you do if I sang out of tune?
We're back at 7 till. Kiplinger, ladies and gentlemen, is where Joan Pride works. She's a senior editor there at Kiplinger. And their outstanding publications come out weekly, biweekly, and monthly. The Kiplinger letter comes out weekly and has for 80 years almost. And the other three biweekly letters are the tax letter, the California letter, and the agricultural letter every other week. And then we have the monthly magazine, Joan.
That's right. It's Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine.
And you can find subscriptions there at Kiplinger.com as well as at this phone number. Joan, go ahead.
Our toll-free number is 800-544-0155.
I like telling people about Kiplinger because they're a small business. They do good work. They really get what you and I do, folks, and all their publications really focus on the individual help and small business help. And I encourage you to check out what they have. Joan, cash-strapped communities are talking about putting, actually many of them may be doing this, putting advertisements on their police cars.
Hard to believe, isn't it?
What do you think?
Well, it just doesn't seem right to me. I understand that they need the money, but it just doesn't seem right. I guess it's not that much different from a bus.
Well, it is different, I think, because a bus is a public conveyance, and I think that they shouldn't do it. I hope they don't do it. I mean, what's next? The governor going to wear a golf shirt with a local company's advertisement on it? You know, the mayor?
I wouldn't say that in public. It might happen.
I know it. I just think that our municipalities have got to be municipalities. They can't be doing these things. And you know, if the golf course, if the local ballpark has advertisement on the outfield fence, that's one thing. But on the police cars, I just think that's getting out of hand.
I agree.
Joan, let's move over and talk about, on page 4, and talk about some exciting things that the SBA is working on. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, we say a more favorable climate is developing for small businesses if you want to start or grow your small business. And we're saying that the SBA is trying to push for relaxing a lot of outdated rules. You know, for a big one, I think, is giving more leeway on tax deposits of employment taxes. I think that would be a big help to small businesses.
Right, absolutely. Another thing that's happening, you know, yesterday, the deputy administrator of the SBA, Melanie Sablehouse, was on the show again. And she is really a cool lady. You'd like meeting her. I need to introduce
her. I've seen her speak, yes.
Well, she, you know what a force she is. I mean,
yes.
She's not just a human being. She's a force.
Right.
But anyway, she was telling us about some of the things that they're working on these days. For example, they're creating venues where small businesses can meet the government agency that can buy what these small businesses sell. And there's one in Chicago coming up in about less than a month, I think. I've forgotten the dates on these, but go to SBA.gov, folks, and you can find out more about these. But
oh,
there are a number of different... Exactly, thank you. The matchmaking, you guys probably reported on that this week, and I just missed it. But yeah, they're doing that, and that's really working, Joan, and they're making more loans to small business. They're guaranteeing more loans to small business, but they've lowered the amounts, the minimums, and so that's helping. And so what they told me the other day is that they're making more loans, but they're just for smaller amounts.
Yeah, that's really important.
It really is, and I'm excited about what the SBA is doing. The government, the federal government, is really helping us. Joan, back on the regulatory thing, our friend Tom Sullivan, who's the chief counsel over there at the advocacy office of the SBA, his office has really been given some teeth to prevent regulations that from ever getting out of Congress as laws that would harm small businesses.
That's right. That goes back to the president's executive order earlier this year that allows the SBA to weigh in on anything like that.
Right. And they've actually put extra power in Tom Sullivan's office.
Right.
To allow him to rein those guys in, and mm-hmm. and you know, in the past, Joan, we didn't know, nobody knew that it hurt us until it was already hurting us.
That's right.
A regulation,
and by then it's too late to, you know, do anything really.
And Joan, I don't know if you and I've talked about this. I think we have, but this is an important statistic that I want to repeat. Big businesses spend about $3,000 per year per employee on regulations. For small businesses, it's double that per employee.
Wow.
It's over $6,000. Think about that. We don't need that to get worse than it is.
No.
We need that trend to go the other way.
Yeah.
Joan, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
Good job today, as always. Look forward to next week.
Sounds great.
Joan Pride, ladies and gentlemen, senior editor with Kiplinger, and she'll be back another day. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners, because without your courage, hard work, and devotion to your dreams, America would not be the greatest entrepreneurial country in the world. And remember today, be guilty of committing a random act of kindness. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.